when incumbent governments, especially of the right, say to populations, this is as good as it gets, our economic plan is working, stick with it. At the moment, rather a lot of people in our societies are thinking, well, if that's working, I don't like it very much, and I wouldn't mind trying a different alternative road, and that's what happened with our referendum.
One for mum, one for dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for.
We'll
just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day. And welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. Next year marks 10 years since the global financial crisis. In 2008, the banks wobbled, the economy stalled, unemployment rose, and the housing market in many countries crashed.
Wall Street's worst day since 9/11.
It was an historic day with Wall Street shaken to its very foundation.
There are fears of a meltdown of the global financial system, with more big institutions crumbling under the global credit crisis.
In Australia, at least, the government acted to head off most of the damage with a stimulus package. But 10 years on, there's record low wages growth, rampant underemployment, and rising inequality. Now the dominant narrative of trickle-down economics is in trouble right across the political spectrum. As the rise of Donald Trump, the vote for Brexit, the embrace of, quote, good debt and bank taxes makes clear, not even the political right believe in neoliberalism anymore. As we approach the 10-year anniversary of the GFC, we at the Australia Institute thought it was time to reflect on what, if anything, we have learned from the GFC. So, working together with the Chifley Research Centre, we invited the UK's former Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, Ed Balls, to tour Australia's East Coast for a series of public talks.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming this evening.
You're about to hear an edited version of the public talk Ed Balls and the former Treasurer Wayne Swan gave at Melbourne Town Hall on August the 22nd, presented in partnership with Guardian Australia. Hosted by the editor of Guardian Australia, Lenore Taylor, who was battling a cold, the evening began by asking Ed Balls to explain exactly how the 28th of April came to be named Ed Balls Day.
Well, it's all a mistake, really. 6 years ago now, I was in a supermarket in Britain called Asda at 5 PM, and somebody in my office had said I had to search something on Twitter, and I'd searched my name, as they told me to, and then I was shopping in Asda, and then my phone rang, and they said, what on earth have you done? And it turned out that my phone spontaneously had chosen to tweet my name, Ed Balls. And it's now been retweeted over 100,000 times. And every year there is a day where people sort of celebrate this Twitter catastrophe.
Do they tweet your name or their own name?
No, they retweet my name. But it's sort of... There was a thing this year. Virgin had an Ed Balls aeroplane. There was a Marmite jar, which had become Ed Balls. Domino's pizza and Ed Domino's. So, I mean, to be honest... As often happens with these kind of public celebrations, it has become a bit commercialised over the over the years. So it's if you told me 2-3 years ago that we would still be celebrating Ed Balls Day every year, if you told me that Jeremy Corbyn would be elected twice as Labour leader, David Cameron would lose an EU referendum, and Donald Trump would become president of the United States, I would have thought you were even more mad. So I think that probably just tells you that it's a bit of a crazy world out there.
It sure is. So, on a serious note, Ed, what do you think's going on?
Well, I think if you take a year ago, our country voted to leave the European Union, to leave an economic trading arrangement with our main trading partners, and after 40 years of kind of deep integration, it was a very unexpected decision. It was a decision which the government had said was a very bad idea. The Bank of England, most of business... most of the financial sector, the IMF, President Obama, our European partners, everybody said don't do it. The country voted by 52% to 48% to leave the EU. And I think when you look hard at why this is going on, when incumbent governments, especially of the right, say to populations, this is as good as it gets, our economic plan is working, stick with it, at the moment, rather a lot of people in our societies are thinking, well, if that's working, I don't like it very much, and I wouldn't mind trying a different alternative road. And that's what happened with our referendum. I reckon there's three things which drive that decision, which have relevance here. First of all, it happened against the background of a global financial crisis, which in our case led not to an ongoing stimulus as Wayne delivered here, but to a deep recession. And a deep recession which then gave way to a government in 2010 which rejected growth policies and went for austerity. And the result is a long period where the economy didn't grow very strongly, and also where the deficit didn't come down, and a sort of sense that the governing elite hadn't really delivered. So when last year people in authority said, this is a good idea, lots of people said, yeah, but you said that you had things under control before and that went wrong. So that's one factor. The second factor, which is very particularly British issue, I think, and different from here, but it was relevant in America as well, is that we had thought globalisation was going to be about money and trade moving around the world, but actually we saw an economic migration. We saw the movement of people on much larger numbers than we had expected as government. Certainly it started under the Labour government and carried on under the Conservatives. And immigration and the government's inability to control it and manage it was the number one issue in the referendum last year, in the same way as it was the number one issue in the election of Donald Trump. And that's just a kind of a reality. We have to think hard about what it means. As I said, I think that's different from the Australian context. But the third thing is that the growth of inequality, and in particular the stagnation of the earnings and the wages of people, and not just at the bottom of the income distribution, but in the middle as well, that we've now in Britain had 15 years where average wages haven't risen in our country. In America, it's been longer. We thought that inequality was going to be people on the lower skills with low education falling behind as the middle and the top continue to prosper. What we've actually seen in Britain and America, and actually around the world, is people on the highest incomes shooting ahead and people in the middle and at the bottom seeing their incomes stagnating. And that sort of stagnation of median wages means we had lots of people in our referendum saying, well, you know, we work hard and play by the rules, but we're worse off and we're not getting better off, and that's not fair. And so in the referendum campaign, the government said, stick with the status quo. And the Leave campaign said, we can leave and take control. And people voted to leave. Now, Australia's not had 10 years of wage stagnation, but you have started to see that in recent years, and clearly rising inequality as well. And I think the question for Australia, as for Britain, is if that inequality, if that stagnation of wages is driving lower growth, a sense of unfairness, but also the kind of populist reaction that you have seen in our politics and in America, well, what are we going to do about it? And because this is very dangerous indeed. If the choice is laissez-faire, free market, business as usual from the right, or from the far right, or sometimes the far left, a sort of Trumpian nationalism, isolate yourself off from the world, this is a pretty unpalatable choice. And so the thing we've been debating is what we can do to make sure we not just have strong growth, but growth which is fairly shared, and rebuild an idea that our societies can work for everyone and not just a few people.
So Wayne, let's start there. Bill Shorten's committed to full employment, but in this labour market with insecure work and casualisation, it's kind of hard to even know what that is or how to measure it.
Australia has done much better in matching growth with equity than most other developed countries in the last 30 years. The difference, say, between having Pauline Hanson in the Senate here and the US having Donald Trump in the White House has been 30 years of real wage increases here for median households, and in the United States, the erosion of median incomes. So it's been those huge reductions in living standards in the United States and to some extent in Britain that have driven the political polarisation and the outcomes that we've seen. So there's no doubt that what this shines a light on is that when you're talking about growth with equity, there is no policy lever more important than ensuring that working people get a fair share of GDP. And you can't build a prosperous economy based on a constantly reducing share of national output going to working people. So the sort of one lesson that I think was really rammed home to me during the global financial crisis and when we put our stimulus in place, and it's the key that demonstrates why it was most effective and what is needed now. We do need real wage growth. Now, one day after the budget, there was an article in the Financial Review, and it said a senior source...
There are never junior sources, by the way.
No, and I know who the senior source was because that's how I used to do it.
Never.
A senior source had told the Financial Review that what Australia needed was a wage breakout. I mean, imagine that, coming from a Conservative politician. So even our current Treasurer was forced to admit off the record this critical role that decent wages and the supports around those wages and a strong labour market play in driving a strong economy. And, of course, that was recognised in the way in which we constructed our stimulus as well, with such spectacular results. So you can't cut your wages towards prosperity, which is a key part of austerity.
But what levers can you pull? Sure. If lots of workers are outside the formal wage system, if unions haven't got the membership they once had, how do you do it?
Well, the very first thing you've got to do is get tight labour markets. Because even if you can go through, and we should do this, the industrial relations system is now inadequate. It needs complete renovation. But unless you've got strong demand in the economy, you're not going to have those workers lifted up into the labour force. So it's absolutely critical that the number one priority is to make sure that in the first instance you can strengthen demand in your economy. And there's plenty of things to be done in this economy. I mean, the IMF is telling the Australian government, it has been for 3 or 4 years, use this period of low interest rates to invest particularly in physical infrastructure and also human infrastructure. I mean, future generations will think us mad that we didn't use this period of record low rates to invest in our infrastructure. So our economy is far weaker than it should be because of the failure of the government to do that. So first of all, strengthen demand. Secondly, renovate. Renovate the industrial relations laws. I think there's a major challenge, given the change in the nature of work, for us to work out how we put a floor in what is our future labour market, given the technological change which is eating away at so many occupations and so many jobs. And an even bigger challenge, when there are so many younger people in Australia under 30 who've never ever had a full-time job.
So is that the minimum wage, or what do you do?
Well, it's a number of things. So what has kept Australia ahead of the pack until now, the last 3 or 4 years, and why we grew more strongly, was the fact through that whole period we had the highest minimum wage in the developed world. First or second, moves around, but consistently the highest minimum wage. So you put a floor in. That minimum wage is now being eroded, particularly by campaigns which are attacking penalty rates and so on. There's also all the illegal activity going on in the labour market, which is also weakening demand for people who don't want to be participants. So there's a whole range of issues in the labour market, bargaining reform, but most importantly, what we've got to do is strengthen the voice of labour at every level. It's not one that is heard enough, and that's not just trade unionism, which I'm a strong supporter of, but it's making sure that workers are much more active in industry. It's putting workers on boards. It's a whole lot of things that need to be done to make sure that the voice of labour is strong in the economy.
The government's determined to support the economy into the future by bringing forward our $76 billion nation-building agenda.
The Deputy Prime Minister has been named as Euromoney's Finance Minister of the Year.
It's a gong for our country more than for any individual.
The Australia Institute did some polling on the Labor government's handling of the GFC, and we found that almost two-thirds of Australians agree the GFC would have sent Australia into recession if the government did not take rapid steps to provide the large fiscal stimulus. But curiously, in 2009, when Parliament was debating the stimulus package, one MP was passed out in his office after drinking too much. Tony Abbott could not be raised by the opposition whips and missed the vote. Wayne Swan first raised the issue 3 years ago while he was still Treasurer.
The Leader of the Opposition slept right through the critical vote. He was drunk and didn't come into the House.
Treasurer will withdraw.
I think quite a few bottles of wine were consumed by the three of us.
So is that
the
same?
I famously slept through several divisions.
It's a pretty important vote too. That was the beginning. That was Rudd's big cash splash.
In defending himself, Tony Abbott insists that Labor was wrong to invest in the stimulus package, using the old truncheon that it put the country in more debt. But the public and a majority of coalition voters disagree. A new report on growing inequality by the Australia Institute's senior economist Matt Grudenoff shows that over the last 19 years, only the top 10% of income earners have seen their incomes rise. And it's this gap between middle income earners and the top 10%, which has more than trebled, that is actually hurting overall economic growth. Both Wayne Swan and Ed Balls think there are things that governments can do.
Well, look, we are both countries, Australia and Britain, which have always been open and international and trading nations. That's what our economic strength has been based upon. We've also always been countries which have taken seriously our obligations to the rest of the world. And the reality is, in the last 30 years, what's happened in terms of growth, rising incomes and poverty reduction in China, in India and across Asia has been a hugely progressive step forward. It would be very unfair on those developing and emerging market economies if they were to be denied those opportunities. But what we do know is that in our countries, you've seen people on the highest incomes, their incomes rising, but people in the middle of the bottom stagnating. And unless we do something about this, I think you are going to see Trump-style American-first reactions against trade and international integration. Now, and I think it's been a real problem that in particular countries in Europe, America, but Britain as well, haven't done their bit to keep the global economy moving. If you want to solve issues like multinational companies not paying the tax they ought to be paying, well, you can't do that as one country. It's got to be done through international coordination and a much tougher attempt to do that. It's not possible to tackle climate change. It's not possible for us to have a way in which a protection for labour or fairness for labour is in trade agreements unless we sit down and talk about how that can be done. The ILO in Geneva, which thinks about these things all the time, has set out some very clear ways in which within trade agreements you can make sure that all countries are making sure that the labour is protected. However, one of the things which came out really strongly in our inclusive prosperity work, which we did a couple of years ago, was there's also loads and loads of things which are our choices. And sometimes when you listen to politicians from the right, they give the impression that we can't do anything unless everything is done internationally. And that's not the case. It is our choice what level of minimum wage we have. It's our choice whether or not we properly respect and pay people who do caring roles, whether that's for the youngest children or for older people in our societies. It's our choice as to whether we invest in public infrastructure, whether we have proper relations driven by local government with universities around innovation, or make sure that we properly focus on vocational learning and skills in the workplace. The reality is that America, which is a much more unfair economy than ours, does very little of that, but I think we've not been doing enough of it.
Do you think the day might come when we have a free trade agreement through which one could take sanctions against a country that didn't fulfil minimum labour standards or didn't comply with their climate obligations?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, and that's what we should aim for. In free market economics, in this sort of the Thatcher-Reagan era and the aftermath, which is that that's the wrong thing to do. If you believe the right way to do things is always smaller government, deregulation, privatisation, you think that's a bad idea. But the reality is that if we're going to sustain public support for trade and for open economics, we're going to have to show people it's being done in a fair way. If you as a country are not taking proper action to tackle child labour, you shouldn't then be trading
cheap goods.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't think it's right to say that everybody must have the same levels of protection or the same minimum wage, but that doesn't mean that we can't say there are certain basic processes or things which countries should do if they're going to be part of the system. If not, you end up with the kind of reactive nationalism which is so damaging to progress and progressive politics.
Well, one of the most vicious forms of protectionism is basically tax evasion. And other countries making it easier for countries to evade taxation in their country. Take Singapore. It's just become a very sophisticated tax haven, which large multinationals in Australia use to avoid tax in Australia. So the use of taxation regimes to make economies more competitive is just a beggar thy neighbour policy and no different from erecting high tariffs against other countries.
While we're on inequality, I wanted to ask you, Wayne, about the very lowest income levels and poverty. In Australia, that is largely people on unemployment benefits because the level of New Start remains a long way below the poverty line. Surely if you want to tackle poverty, that's the place you'd start.
Well, it's part and parcel of all of that, no question about that. When we were in government through the recession, we put our priority on keeping people in work, and we did that very successfully. In Tasmania, as a result of the stimulus, it had its lowest level of unemployment in decades in the middle of a global financial crisis. So we took a priority to create jobs. But yes, I think New Start certainly needs to be increased.
The reality is the big change which has happened in 20 years in Britain is that amongst working-age people, poverty was predominantly about unemployment. And the big shift is that a growing and growing share of working-age poverty is actually people in work, working full-time, but on wages, which make it very hard for them to make ends meet. We've also seen a big rise in self-employment, which sometimes is a great thing, and sometimes is actually a disguised form of employment where people are actually employed but don't get sickness pay, holiday pay. It's really important to have a policy to tackle unemployment, to get people back to work, but you can have full employment economies these days in which lots of people are not only underemployed but actually being employed on pretty tough wages, terms and conditions. And so the nature of employment these days is as important as how we tackle unemployment.
How about taxation? We've touched on it, but I'd just like from each of you your sort of top of the pops wish list on the changes in the taxation system that would make the system more equitable.
When I became the Shadow Chancellor in 2011, and I met our business organisation a year after we'd come out of government and said to them, what's your top priority? They said the top priority for the business organisation in Britain was to cut the top rate of income tax from 50% to 45% for people earning over £150,000, over $200,000 a year, because that was the thing which was holding Britain back. And 5 years on, with those kind of attitudes having in part led to us voting to leave the European Union, I think businesses realising that fairness in taxation, in income tax and also in the way the corporate tax system works is far from being a barrier to growth and investment, is actually something we have to tackle in order that we can win public support for growth and investment. So even compared to in our country a couple of years ago, people are seeing that a more progressive tax system is essential if we're going to sustain public support for a market economy.
Well, getting rid of all the loopholes that mean that people who are on high incomes can avoid the nominal rate. So the effective rate is well below the nominal rate. That's the case for many companies in the company tax system, and it's the same in the income tax system, because that's the only way the revenues will be raised in an equitable way to fire growth and to support the jobs we were talking about before.
I think it was just this week, wasn't it? It's hard to keep up with the US. Steve Bannon, when he went back to Breitbart, remarked that if the left focuses on race, we can crush the Democrats. Is he right?
Wayne and I have been talking about this a lot in the last few days. Of course it is the case that these are important issues. You know, I'm a huge champion of the changes we've made over the last few years to move from civil partnerships to have marriage equality in our law, and it's been a very positive step forward. But we can't allow those issues to be the only inequalities we talk about. We've also got to talk about inequality of economic opportunity as well. There are, in our country, lots of people who feel as they are excluded from those conversations because of who they are, and that's a problem. So it's important that you win the support of all working people, that we need to have these kind of reforms. And sometimes when you look like you're dividing working people, that kind of causes some of the reaction.
Right.
Well, Trump and all his mates, and they've been doing this in the US for 30 years, have an underlying program for wealth concentration and income concentration, wage suppression, tax cuts for the rich. And they seek to disguise that by then using wedge issues when it comes to the politics of race and the politics of gender. And the challenge we have on the left of politics is to not let them get away with that. And one way of doing that is not to let our economic message be drowned out by the important debates about racial and gender equality. They're very important. They're an essential part of opportunity for everybody.
OK, that really is all we have time for. I'd like to thank Ed and Wayne for a really thought-provoking and interesting evening. I'd like to thank the Australia Institute for putting this on, and I particularly like to thank you, the audience.
That's been episode 21 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. For further information about our report on growing income inequality or our survey on the government's handling of the GFC, head on over to our website at tai.org.au. And here you'll also find previous podcast episodes. You can subscribe to Follow the Money on iTunes or wherever you download your favourite podcast. And please don't forget to give us a rating if you can. We'd like to thank Lenore Taylor from Guardian Australia for hosting the live event in Melbourne. And thanks also to Chifley Research Centre for partnering with the Australia Institute to make the speaking tour with Ed Balls and Wayne Swan possible. You can follow the Australia Institute on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. I'm on Twitter at Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Wayne Swan is at SwanyQLD and Ed Balls is at Ed Balls. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track. Additional music composed by Paul Macy. We'll leave you with a song from The Lurkers. Thanks for listening.
Down on dirty Wall Street, the truth is hard to find. Lay a dirty greenback down, you've got a dirty life. Up on hollow Main Street, the truth is what you're told. A happy life, it can be bought, a happy life is sold. And the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the monument of capital is rotten.